Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast, the industry's first and longest-running podcast, now in our 16th year. This week we feature a discussion with Keith White, the Executive Director of the National Council on Problem Gambling, on the start of March, the official Problem Gambling Awareness Month. 20 years ago, IGT transformed the industry by introducing cashless gaming with Tito. Now IGT is revolutionizing cashless yet again. Learn more about IGT's resort wallet at IGT.com/cashless. Well, I'm standing at the crossroads with my rod about my side. Standing at the crossroads. The National Council on Problem Gambling is an important organization in the gaming industry's efforts to promote responsible gaming. The NCPG was formed in 1972 as a neutral organization designed to collaborate with a broad range of people and organizations to alleviate the ravages of problem gambling. Keith White has been executive director since 1998 and has guided the organization to become one of the key players in responsible gaming. With a stellar board of directors and advisors, the NCPG designates the month of March as Problem Gambling Awareness Month, with a variety of programs to focus on the issue. White spoke with me via Zoom from his offices in Washington, D.C. in late February. Keith White, thanks for joining us on the podcast today. It's good to see you, virtually anyway. Hopefully within the next year we'll see each other in person, but it's nice to get together.
Absolutely. It's great to see you.
So let's talk about Problem Gambling Awareness Month. This is going to air initially on March 1st, the start of the month. So give us some background on that event and what you hope to accomplish with it.
Well, 19 years ago, we thought we needed a national awareness event for the gambling field. Mm-hmm. So we modeled it on similar efforts in the drug and alcohol abuse field. You know, Breast Cancer Awareness Month, you know, every disease or disorder has an awareness event. And we thought that the problem gambling field needed one as well. And it turns out you can just sort of proclaim these things.
Right.
And so we went to the federal government. There's a National Health Observances Register and said, hey, we'd like to make March Problem Gambling Awareness Month. And they said, great. And then it was on us, of course, to work with allies in the industry and in the public health community to really make this to live a real grassroots campaign. And so for the last 19 years, that's what we've been doing. We've been growing every year, and it's been really fun. But it's a great opportunity just to talk about the issue and build alliances.
Sure. And what are some of the things you do during the month to bring awareness to problem gambling?
Well, I think the first thing is, we try and really encourage our state affiliate chapters to hold conferences. So most of our 35 affiliates will do something at the state level. We encourage the state health agencies to do something, and about half of the mm-hmm. states do something. We work with our communications manager, John Norton, reaches out and encourages states to do a governor's proclamation or resolution. And again, we get about half the states who do mm-hmm. do something around that. So on the public awareness side, it's a lot of the traditional things. We also, the second major goal of Problem Gambling Awareness Month is to encourage healthcare providers to screen their clients. So during March, if you go in for a physical, we'd love your GP to ask you about
sure.
this. If you're in treatment for drug or alcohol abuse, or if you show up for a behavioral health visit, maybe you're depressed or something, we'd love that the provider to ask you a question or two about your gambling.
Okay.
And if it does seem like gambling could be a contributing issue, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they can probe further or start to refer to people like us. So it's,
sure.
it's a twofold thing. One, general public awareness, and two, working within the existing system. As you talk a lot about co-occurring disorders, we want to work within that existing system to make sure that people are screening for gambling problems, at least during the month, if not year-round.
Okay. And this issue is becoming that much more important because of the legalization of sports betting and online gaming is now spreading, of course. So how have you responded? How has the NCPG responded to this kind of activity?
We did two things. On the policy front, we launched in 2018, in May of 2018, so before the decision came down, but I think a lot of us knew where that was going,
sure.
knew that PAPSPA was just a weird law on its face, and that the compelling arguments to overturn it were pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
So in early in 2018, we launched our Safer Sports Betting Initiative, and that simply was a set of policy recommendations for states, for regulators, and for the industry and for media on how to handle the legalization of sports betting. And then the other thing we did was we commissioned a very large survey called the National Survey of Gambling Attitudes and Gambling Experiences. ENGAGE is the not great acronym. But with funding from GVC, who is now Entain, we surveyed 3,000 people nationwide, and we oversampled 400 sports bettors in every state. So we talked to a total of 28,000 people in November of 2018 to get a baseline on attitudes and opinions about, you know, gambling and gambling addiction in general, but specifically about sports betting. And so now with that baseline, we can start to measure change, because as you know, most states were either unwilling or unable or uninterested in establishing a baseline prior to the legalization of sports betting or tracking it afterwards. So it was kind of left to us to sort of set that.
Okay.
And it'll be interesting to see.
Okay. So you mentioned Entain. I know they've been doing a lot of investment into the responsible gaming area, you know, not only with you guys, but with UNLV and other organizations. But there's a lot of other companies coming into this betting arena now that have never been traditional sports betting companies, like the pro leagues and the fantasy sports companies and stadiums and arenas, for that matter. So how have you responded to the responsibility to make sure that these companies are aware of problem gambling and are doing their part?
It's a huge challenge to help folks that are not in the gambling industry understand what responsible gambling is. Right. I mean, to the credit of the industry, to the credit of all the work we've done, to the credit of publishers like you, people that are in the gambling industry, they get responsible gambling. They may not always love it, but by and large, they accept it and they act on it. It's leagues and sports media that are outside our traditional field. That's a real struggle. Frankly, they haven't internalized responsible gambling. They just, and frankly, a lot of times they just see dollars signs, and it's been very, very hard to convince them that this social responsibility is different than other fields they may be in. And so it's a great question. It's frankly been an ongoing challenge, and I still think there are some leagues, if you will, that don't understand at all the higher obligation they have when it comes to legalized gambling. Sure. They just simply don't get it.
Okay. So you've made some inroads into these companies like Entain, and I guess they've already been in the gambling industry, though, even though it was overseas. But these companies that haven't been in the industry that are now getting into it, you have to make a special effort, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's exactly right. And often it is our gambling partners that really help convince those folks that have the need. You know, so it's great when we always live and love our partnership model. And it's great when you can have a company like an Entain, an MGM, a Caesars go to these other partners outside the industry and say, you know, listen to what the National Council's saying. We want you to do this because it's good for us.
Right.
You know, not just, you know, and so it's really good to have that corporate support when we need it the most, because they will listen to the gambling companies in a way that sometimes they're not accustomed to listening to groups like the National Council, just because they're not familiar with us. We're lucky. We've got really good relationships within the gambling industry, and we're using that to our benefit to help educate the non-gambling folks who are flooding into this space.
Great. So the pandemic has been a real issue for problem gambling. Obviously, when people are stuck at home, they've got nothing else to do. A lot of them, you know, start to gamble, and some of them, you know, people who have that proclivity are have problems with it. So what have you been doing to kind of approach that issue?
We've tried to raise awareness amongst the gambling industry that, you know, as they shift, as they deal with the pandemic, both among their customers and their employees, there may be higher risk factors for gambling problems. You know, so we encourage regulators to require the industry to incorporate problem gambling into COVID reopening plans. Not many did, but the ones I think that did were pretty far-sighted, and we want to give them a lot of credit. Pennsylvania and Nevada in particular, I think, had some specific responsible gambling provisions in their COVID reopening plans. And then, you know, we just urge the industry to be mindful and monitor. So it's the two M's. You know, make sure that if you're doing good responsible gambling pre-pandemic, you're doing it during the pandemic, and that you have some specific responsible gambling messages that may be related to the pandemic. And then monitoring, you know, using all that information data you collect for to also analyze responsible gambling, because that's where you're going to see warning signs. You know, if you've got an existing customer who, you know, maybe you lost for a few months during the pandemic, but they come back, and if they come back on fire, you know, as you know, Roger, it's never good for the long-term sustainability of the industry. You know, to have a customer that was a $100 a month customer who's now coming back at $1,000 a month. Sure. And, you know, maybe that indicates they just got a huge raise during the pandemic. Right. But maybe that indicates they're trying to gamble to make up for sure. something they've lost.
Right.
So I think it's been interesting, but, you know, helpline calls have been all over the map because as we knew, but I think the pandemic showed, when people aren't in casinos, they don't see the helpline number.
Sure.
You know, when people aren't buying lottery tickets, they're not seeing that number. And so it's been interesting. The industry plays such a huge role in the promotion of, in the visibility of the problem gambling helpline.
Sure. No question. You know, we've seen a lot of research being done into this, but it's still in the preliminary stages. I know that they did some research in Australia with Sally Gainsbury and Alex Blazinski, some interesting preliminary research, but they were limited to a certain extent. Have you seen any research in terms of what this has done in terms of problem gamblers? Has it really increased the problem gambling proclivity at this point?
I don't think it's increased it at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I do think research always lags a couple of years,
sure,
and I think
right.
problem gambling lags a couple of years.
Right.
You know, so we may well be looking at an increase in gambling, but 2 to 3 years down the road, because it takes a while for people to really crash out,
you know,
to crash and burn.
Sure.
It takes about 6 months for the average male problem gambler, and between 3 to 5 years for the average female problem gambler.
Okay.
So, it's going to be interesting to see, but I don't think it's been as bad as it could have been. You know, there's been some interesting research in Canada that not as many people shifted to online gambling as I would have expected.
Right.
And I think it's true. Most of that was, it would have been illegal in Canada
right,
and
sure.
the US. So that's a good thing that most people didn't mm-hmm. shift, but I don't think as many people shifted as I would have expected.
Sure. Absolutely. So another spinoff of the pandemic is the really rapid growth of cashless gaming. We just did an article in our March issue by Sally and Alex on cashless gaming and how it's got pros and cons for problem gambling. You can get a lot of transparency. You can see exactly what they're betting, and a problem gambler can really look at what they're doing. On the other hand, they have access to their bank account at all times. So how do you think the industry needs to control that?
It's a great point. And I think, cashless is in some ways, it's just new technology.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of discussions around internet that we all went through about a decade ago. And I think that this technology, be it internet, be it cashless, is value neutral. It's how and why we use it that's going to make it a net positive or net negative. And so we have been encouraged, as Sally said, there's a lot of potential for responsible gambling within cashless gaming. And there's a lot of reasons why it could be done in a way that's probably going to minimize harm. But there's risk there too. Unfortunately, what we're seeing, like in Nevada, those regulations, they opened up and removed a lot of limits on cashless
right.
without, at the same time that they tried to cut the problem gambling budget by 70%.
Right, exactly.
At the same time that they removed the limits on debit transactions,
right.
The research was pushed down the road at least 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not really going to get a good impact, for a couple of years. And by that time, I think the regulations will be in place and there may well have been some harm. So we're cautiously optimistic, I should say, that vendors and operators are going to do the right thing. But that's the rub. Government regulators who should be taking a much bigger share of the problem gambling burden have really dumped it on the industry. And they're the ones that are going to be pointing their fingers to vendors and operators
sure.
to say, well, why haven't you guys done anything? And the vendors and operators aren't bringing in this tax revenue.
Right.
So I think we see this a lot with responsible gambling. Regulators aren't really stepping up, and to the point of Richard Schutz's article.
Right.
They're not really
sure.
putting the money into this. And it dumps the burden on the operators and vendors in a way that's maybe not fair. And we have a really good natural alliance with vendors and operators around responsible gambling to push back on states and say, look, you guys are making windfall tax revenues off this. Some of this should be going to responsible gambling. You shouldn't leave it on us to do that basic research.
Sure. No question. Yeah. No. So Nevada, a couple of years ago, finally legalized or finally established a gambling court, very similar to the drug courts, where people who commit crimes, to feed their gambling habit, are given treatment options and things of that nature. And it's been very successful here in Nevada. It's now spreading to other states. I know New Jersey's got an active procedure they're trying to set up. How do you feel about those kind of things? You think that needs to be done in more states?
Absolutely. Gambling courts have been overwhelmingly successful in every jurisdiction that they've been introduced. And, you know, it's there. So there's an ethical imperative, which means, you know, it's just better for the gambler and their family, their victim even, as well as society, to make sure that they're getting treatment instead of incarceration. But maybe even more importantly, there's an economic imperative, because it costs a ton of money to first have the person with a gambling problem commit that crime, and then to prosecute them, and then to incarcerate them. And then what do you do when they're out and they still have the gambling problem? You know, they're still costing society.
Sure, right.
The two biggest drivers of state budget deficits are criminal justice costs and healthcare costs. Gambling courts address both of those. And so it's, you know, most problem gamblers won't commit a crime to finance their gambling. But those who do, it tends to be a white collar crime. It tends to be related to money, you know, that they're getting money to gamble. And so, you know, the cost benefit of the gambling treatment court is just, it's overwhelmingly a net positive. And so I think, as you know, it's one of those policy solutions that there's really no downside.
Sure.
And so it's pretty exciting. We've been working for a number of years to get federal legislation that would fund evaluation of gambling treatment courts, that would fund a manual, so that other states don't have to do the hard work that New Jersey's doing right now, because it takes years to kind of get the model going. If we can to get a national model, it'll make it a lot easier for the court for the courts to roll out. State across the country.
Okay.
And that's, I think that's a good role for the National Council.
Okay, great.
Resort Wallet from IGT provides a digital wallet for all your players' gaming and retail needs. From card or cardless-based cashless transactions, your players will love the convenience of getting rid of cash and all the hassles associated with using cash. And with IGT Pay, IGT's exclusive payment gateway, your players can fund their cashless wagering accounts from multiple external sources simultaneously. The benefits of cashless gaming are amazing. No more waiting in lines at ATMs to get cash, no more waiting in lines to redeem your tickets, and no more waiting for service when your ticket printer jams. Learn more about IGT's Resort Wallet at igt.com/cashless. And now back to our podcast.
So when I first started covering the gaming industry back in the 80s, there was virtually no research that had been done on problem gambling, virtually none. You know, with the establishment of the National Center for Responsible Gaming, now there's some being done. But in other countries, though, now it's booming. It's a little cottage industry in Australia and Canada, you know. And we don't really know, you know, what's going on there. Let's just start with this country first. I mean, NCBG and the National Center for Responsible Gaming, now the International Center for Responsible Gaming, are the two major organizations. What's the difference between your two organizations?
I think you described it really well in your article. They concentrate on research and we concentrate on services for problem gamblers.
Right.
And so there's really no, there's really not much overlap. And so theoretically we could and do and should work a lot closer together, because they're kind of in that lane and we're sort of in the services lane. So it's a nice, even though the organizations are separate, there's a really nice synergy there.
Sure.
And one of the things we need to do as advocates is to go to Congress and to make sure that some of that almost $8 billion in gambling tax revenue gets put into the federal health system and returned as grants to states and to nonprofits like us, because we need to prime that pump. Problem gambling is the only disease or disorder that doesn't have any federal funding. And so right now, again, states and the industry have to bear the brunt of, you know, they've got to bear the burden for funding this research in a way that most other industries don't. And so we think that it's just and appropriate to take some of that gambling tax revenue that goes to the federal level and return it back to the states, return it back to colleges and universities in the form of grants. That would help us, and that would definitely help NCRG, because as they say all the time, they're 100% funded by the gambling industry.
Sure, right.
And it's just not appropriate in a lot of ways for the industry to have to bear that entire burden.
Right.
And the federal government, if you're making $8 billion, you should bear some of that burden.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. And to be fair, the money that funds it, it goes into, it's a blind research, and there's no influence, you know.
Absolutely, yeah, no.
But you're right, I mean, the government should be more involved in that, the National Science Center. I mean, the government did the really the initial research that found during the National Gambling Impact Study Commission back in the late 90s that found, you know, the number of problem gamblers, percentage of problem gamblers, which has been found to be the same, you know, throughout the years all the way up to now, you know. So the government started that, and they should probably continue on doing that. So a lot of the things that gambling has uncovered is that if you have a problem with gambling, you usually have a problem with other things, with drugs or alcohol or sex or whatever, it's comorbidity that makes it very, very difficult to treat it. Do you think that there could be something that would come out where you could treat just problem gambling, or do you have to treat them all at the same time?
Yeah, it's a good question. So for some folks, gambling is probably their primary problem.
Right.
And there's for other folks, maybe the majority of folks with gambling problems, it's really a secondary problem. You know, it's kind of a crude way to think about it, but it's like, what's causing the most damage in your life? You know, what is it that's hardest to kick? And if it's gambling, then you'd want to treat the gambling first. And there are some unique features about gambling. But if it's really, if you're gambling to escape the problems that your drinking has caused, you're probably going to want to address the drinking first.
Right.
But again, if you're drinking because you've just lost your house, you know, at the poker game,
right,
then, you know, probably get to the gambling first. And there's a complex interplay. I mean, I do think one of the things that makes gambling addiction really interesting and unique from a research perspective is that technology changes it so profoundly. You know, we brew beer the same way the Egyptians brewed beer 3,000 years ago. The way we gamble today is different than it was last week, much less last year.
Right.
And that's gonna change again. And that does have clinical implications. So it's fascinating to watch the way in-play betting, for example, on a cashless, on your mobile device, in a cashless one-click environment is maybe different, or may impact some people with addiction much more than, let's say, they were placing the same sports bet, or they couldn't even place that same sports bet a year ago.
Sure.
So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember when I first started covering the research, they got into the brain synapses and things like that. And I was never good at chemistry or biology, so it just didn't work for me.
I look at some of that stuff and I think someone tell me what it means.
Yeah. They're starting to dumb it down for me, so I feel better about it now. So another issue in terms of cooperation between organizations in the industry is that, you know, every gambling company now is coming out with a problem gambling program, whether they had it or not. I mean, Harris/Caesars has had it since the early 90s, you know, and other companies, Boyd Gaming, you know, was one of the originals in there too. But everybody seems to have a real their own little way to do it. It's almost proprietary. I remember, you know, just last year, Hard Rock came out with theirs, and they have a whole different approach. They're a little bit more let's have fun with it, you know. And then if you do have a problem with it, you know, and a lot of Hard Rock's approach is to educate people on the bets, you know, which I always thought was a great idea, which was always our thing when I started Casino Player magazine back in the 80s, you know, educate people on what they're betting. So do you think there should be more cooperation amongst the gambling companies who are putting out these programs, that there's, I don't want to say one size fits all, but you know, kind of recognizing, you know, similar approaches to the issue?
Yes, I do. And I think one of the things that we've always said, one of our goals is, you know, because we'll never have a national gambling regulator, right? So in the UK, for example, they do more of a top-down approach.
Right.
Everybody shall do this.
Mm-hmm.
I think that doesn't work for a number of reasons.
Right.
But we do believe in voluntary national harmonization. So we would like to help work with the industry, as we did on Internet Responsible Gambling Standards.
Sure.
We want to work with the industry to identify both you know, some common best practices, so that, as you say, not every company is going it alone. And most importantly, I think it'll make it easier for operators and vendors that work across jurisdictions. And I think, but most importantly, it'll make it easier for players. Because right now, one of the problems with the approach that you outlined is, if every company's got a really different responsible gambling standard, we know players go across multiple properties all the time. And so they can get whiplash from trying to figure out what the responsible gambling thing is walking down the street. They may hit three different programs. So I think a little bit more voluntary harmonization to tell folks, this is the core. We know these are the common elements that everyone should have. And then if you want to add your own brand and you want to do other things, that's fine. And I think we're still a little bit a ways from that. We don't really have, again, the good research, nor do we have necessarily industry rallying behind that mm-hmm. idea. You know, everybody's still kind of doing it on their own, and that's fine. But I do think eventually you're going to want to come together and have a set of basic minimum standards.
Right.
And I do think the National Council can play a good role in that. We did that with internet. So in 2012, we saw internet was coming. We went all around the world, talked to all different jurisdictions, operators, vendors, regulators, and said, here's a set of best practice, minimum standards. These aren't, you know, it's not everything, but minimum standards. And DGE, New Jersey Division of Gaming Enforcement, incorporated every single one of them into mm-hmm. their regulations because it was turnkey.
Sure.
And that made it easy.
Right, right. So you think eventually they're gonna come together in some sort of, you know, again, minimum standards and they'll be able to adhere to the same kind of operations and not necessarily the same programs, but the same goals anyway.
We'd like to see that, and that's something the National Council would push for. I mean, I think it's important if you look at responsible gambling as a consumer focused feature, you know, not as an operator focused mm-hmm. thing, but really you're doing it on behalf of your players. Then you want to make sure that there's commonality across your approaches.
Sure.
And I think it's a good opportunity. It's a good opportunity to start to know that scenario is only possible when we start to know what works. And so it's going to take some evaluation. The kinds of things that MGM's doing right now, they've hired UNLV to evaluate their GameSense program that's run across jurisdictions, mm-hmm. across properties. And I think the more companies that do that, we'll be able to look at those evaluations and say, hey, here's the seven things that should be common to everybody's responsible gaming program. It's proven to work at MGM. It's proven to work at Caesars. Let's just make that the floor for the industry.
Sure, sure.
And I think that helps everybody.
Yeah, no question about that. So, you know, I missed a lot of good conferences last year, and one that I really missed was your conference. I always found it interesting. You have a wide variety of speakers and subjects. So how did you accomplish that this year, and what are we going to see going forward on this conference?
You know, we sort of tried to roll with it and say, okay, if we're going to have to be online, let's try and take advantage of the format. We can reach more people, not just across the U.S., but around the world. You know, I think we learned a lot about how people want shorter bites of content. You know, people are looking for they're looking not just around the U.S. nowadays, but around the world. You know, so we started to pull in a lot more speakers from international jurisdictions. There's some exciting scary responsible gambling initiatives in the UK. There's some neat stuff in Scandinavia and Australia. And so I think one thing we deliberately did was broaden the conference in terms of international mm-hmm. best practice. The other thing is we made a real big effort to increase diversity.
Okay.
You know, we wanted to make sure that our conference reflected what the United States is, you know, diverse
right.
mosaic.
Sure.
And so, and it wasn't hard, but we had a majority of female presenters,
mm-hmm.
Which is rare for industry
Very
conferences.
Rare.
You know, we made sure that we had 25% of our speakers were individuals of color. And I think, you know, and it's not that it was that hard. It has to be a little bit deliberate. And those are two trends that we're going to continue. So I think July of this year, you're going to see a conference that that looks even more at what's happening internationally, both the positive things and the negative things. Because I think there is possibly some overreaction
mm-hmm.
in jurisdictions like the UK.
Sure, sure.
You know, and then I think you're going to see a renewed emphasis on diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Okay.
And again, I think there's a great opportunity for folks in the industry, in the gambling industry, who responsible gambling is not always the path to the executive suite. But maybe especially for individuals of color working in the gambling industry, this is a good way to get noticed. This is a good way to get a national speaking gig,
mm-hmm.
you know, to start to think about working on the responsible gambling side of things. I think it's increasingly valuable.
Sure.
It's a skill set that's going to really help you across jurisdictions mm-hmm. in your career path. So we're trying to lean into that on the RG side of our conference a little bit,
yep.
and really try and encourage those junior executives, people that are up and coming, and especially junior executives of color, to think about what they might have to contribute in terms of how to reach communities of color, how to live responsible gambling in this online environment.
Sure.
You know, I think there's some neat stuff around that.
Yeah, that's a great approach. We always like to see new speakers at these conferences, and that's a great way to go for it. So just my last question is, you know, there has been this increased attention on responsible gaming over the last year or two because of this expanded online gambling, you know. And then when you look at the backlash, I think gambling has gotten in the UK and certainly Australia, sometimes in some cases in Canada. You know, I think by staying out front and staying proactive when it comes to responsible gaming, you know, we'll be able to blunt that effect in the United States. Are you encouraged by the more attention we're getting to this problem?
I'm cautiously encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's some companies and some jurisdictions that are really doing it right, that are not just leaning into it, but that have truly made it part of their corporate culture, part of their KPIs, you know, part of their mission. But there's still far too many companies and far too many regulators and states who, if they think about responsible gambling at all, it's is an afterthought or a charity. You know, it's not in anybody's structure.
Sure.
If you look at a lot of gaming commissions, it's all about protecting the money
mm-hmm.
and ensuring the integrity.
Right.
There's nothing about protecting the consumer. And so I do think online starts to expose those cracks even more.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great opportunity for those companies that are doing it well to use that as a selling point. You know, when everyone's looking at new jurisdictions, you know, being able to say that you've got a solid RG track record when maybe some of your competitors don't, I think should be a differentiator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think regulators should look at that as well when they're looking at limited licenses. So, you know, online does, it's interesting. Online starts to reveal a lot about a company culture.
Mm-hmm.
And we've seen some companies jump into it and do the same, if not more, responsible gambling in their online operations because they know a lot more about their customers.
Sure.
We've seen other companies jump into the online world and, you know, they haven't embraced responsible gambling at all. They're going to do the bare minimum. They're not going to use any of these new tools and technologies to do anything different. And, but I think it's a lot easier to see now. There's a lot more scrutiny on the industry in the online space, for better or for worse.
Sure.
And I do think it starts to show who are the ones that really live it and who are the ones that are just kind of, you know, paying lip service to it.
Right. So you think regulators are kind of behind the eight ball a little bit on this as well?
I think they should be. And I think, again, regulators really have to evolve their understanding.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to understand that regulating this industry doesn't mean just counting the money and just
right.
keeping out cheats. It's got to be protecting your players.
Mm-hmm.
Again, both for an ethical reason,
mm-hmm.
but for an economic reason.
Yeah.
Because if you don't pay attention to the social costs, they're going to outweigh the revenue that you gather. And regulators have a really important job a really important role to play in helping both the industry and their state public health sector do this the right way. You know,
right.
regulators are kind of, they're at a crucial linchpin point. We don't want them to be psychologists. You know, they're not
sure,
public
right.
health people.
No.
They shouldn't be.
Right.
But they set the rules of the game. And they can, you know, even with subtle nudges to their licensees, subtle nudges to their rules and regs, they can do enormous good, not just for the industry and themselves and their players, but for their whole, you know, the whole point of legalized gambling is to benefit the jurisdiction.
Sure.
But net benefit.
Right.
And the more regulators think about gambling as a net benefit, and the more they look at that cost benefit, the more I think they're going to benefit from responsible gambling.
Right. And my point is, if they had been paying attention to this in the UK, you know, they wouldn't have had to crack down on the operators, because they would have had these regulations in place, or at least these controls in place, so that the operators might not have stepped over whatever line they thought they stepped over, because there was no line.
And the line shifts.
Right, exactly.
And that's
right,
really
yeah.
difficult too. Yeah, no, I've got a lot of sympathy for folks that are kind of getting whipsawed in the UK. And I do think it really shows our model has always been one of partnership. We're advocates for problem gamblers, but we'd rather be positive advocates. We'd rather celebrate these successes, work with the industry on these partnerships, you know, develop guidelines, you know, that really help unite the industry. But we'll also be negative advocates. You know, we'll call out folks that we think are not doing the right thing. We'll call out jurisdictions that don't. Still today, there are states that bring in billions of dollars in gambling revenue and don't put a single cent back into problem gambling programs. But I think we can avoid a backlash by working together But it's you know, it has to be sincere. And the other thing we've learned is that it's not enough for there just to be a few leaders and then a lot of followers. You know, we have to judge, and the media and the politicians and regulars, they judge the industry by the lowest common standard.
Sure.
So even if company X is doing a great thing and they're, you know, they're all over the headlines, everybody acknowledges them as a leader, when their peers right next to them are doing really poor responsible gambling, that reflects badly on everybody. And I think that's been a hard lesson for the industry to learn, especially the leading companies.
Sure.
You know, but through organizations like the AGA, through the peer, you know, through the network we have in gambling, I think the industry really has a role to play in helping some of those other companies get up to snuff, because it's going to hurt them one way or the other.
Yeah, no question. Well, Keith, thanks for joining us, we're excited that the we're excited that the Responsible Gambling Awareness Month, or Problem Gambling Awareness Month, is going to be a success this year. And next year will be the 20th anniversary of this, so we'll have to get together again and really promote it at that point as well.
We'd love to, and it'll be NCPG's 50th anniversary next year.
That's
we're gonna have a double anniversary.
Okay.
But it's always a pleasure. I really appreciate it, and we really appreciate the role that GGB has played and you have played in advancing responsible gambling. And it's just really to your credit. It's a great benefit to everybody. So thank you.
Okay. Well, good to see you, Keith, and we'll talk soon.
My pleasure. Thanks, Roger.
We can sit at my house, baby.
Hope you enjoyed this week's podcast brought to you by IGT. Your players will experience the convenience of digital transactions throughout your resort property with IGT's Resort Wallet. Learn more about Resort Wallet at igt.com/cashless. To learn more about responsible gaming in the casino industry, visit ggbmagazine.com. To get all the news of the gaming industry, particularly of the coronavirus situation and its impact on gaming, including daily updates, subscribe for free at ggbnews.com by using the code GGB180. Don't miss a single episode of the podcast. Subscribe on iTunes and Spotify today. So we'll see you next time on the GGB Podcast.
Well, I'm